10:13.
Familiar verse. I was talking to Steve after the service Sunday night. He was saying that kind of a discouraging message to him, and thinking it through, unless you understand the other side of it, then a message that deals harshly with sin certainly can be a discouragement. The other side is 1 Corinthians 10:13. There we read, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer, will not allow you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it." I want to talk to you tonight just briefly about victory and God's promise. The verse is pretty well known. Satan hates this verse because he would like to keep the illusion that we have to give in to sin. But it's really time in the context of dealing with sin to meditate on it again. We'll find it literally bursting with life-changing meaning. What we need to see in this, then, first of all, this verse tells us of the commonality of your temptation, the commonality of your trial. "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man." And so the trial you face has been endured by other fellow Christians. We tend to say, "I feel that I'm all alone." But that, again, is illusion or even superstition. It is a feeling that we have that's not based in reality. The fact is, it seems painfully lonely on a path of tribulation, on a path of trial. Nobody, as you look around, nobody seems to be going through what you're going through. But if you look down on that path, that dusty path, there are footprints of many, many other people who've gone that way before. Might not be happening right now at this time, at this place with you. People say, "I don't know of anybody going through my trial." Well, it's not surprising that you feel alone. Sin is not a spectator sport. The nature of struggling against sin is to keep it a secret. In John 3:19-20, "This is the condemnation, that light is come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light." Why? "Because their deeds were evil. For every one that doth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved." So the point is, the people walking around you may be going through the same trials of temptation that you are. They're just not talking about it. So the trial you face has been endured by others, other fellow Christians. But even more importantly, the trial that you face has been endured by Jesus Christ. We may be tempted to play our electronic games, and he never was, but the temptation is the same, to idle time in a non-productive way. Hebrews 4:15 says, "For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities." In other words, we don't have a high priest that can't be touched. We do have a high priest that was touched with our infirmities, our weaknesses. "But he was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin." So he not only faced it, he faced it successfully. So Jesus faced every temptation, every trial that you face, and he did so in his ordinary humanity. Let me just remind you of Philippians 2:6-7, "Who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation." That word actually refers to emptied himself. Being God, never stopping to be God, he laid aside the independent use of his godly privileges, took upon him the form of a servant, a slave, and was made in the likeness of men. So if he was not tempted by cocaine, he was tempted with the drugs of his day. What is it? Heroin, morphine, some of these things go way, way back. certainly alcohol was around in his day. If he was not tempted with internet porn, he was tempted by prostitutes that he saw day by day. So all temptations can be categorized into three basic forms, no matter what the particular things they are now. One, 1 John 2:16, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the inordinate desire of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, this is looking out, wanting what you see, and the pride of life, that's a word meaning boastful pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. So lust of the flesh is the desire to enjoy things that God forbids. People say, well, but this makes me happy. And the answer is, so what? That's not any excuse to do it, you see. What about the serial killer who, you know, cutting holes in people and pulling things out of their body, it makes him happy, you know? Are we to say, well, you know, to each his own? No, it's just wrong. So overeating, drunkenness, loving sleep too much, sexual activity outside the bounds of proper marriage, all of these things God forbids. When Jesus had fasted 40 days, the devil tempted him to turn a stone into bread. This was the temptation to enjoy food by a procedure that God had forbidden, and Jesus said no. So the lust of the flesh is the desire to enjoy things that God forbids. The lust of the eyes is covetousness. It is the desire to possess things, but to possess things that God forbids. So the sins of materialism and covetousness. Satan took Jesus to a high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world. He tempted him with the desire to possess. The catch was that Jesus had to worship Satan to get it. And who would know? Who would have known? See, they're all by themselves in this thing, up on a high mountain. So this was, in essence, for Jesus, a get-rich-quick scheme. The slow, painful way for Jesus to gain those kingdoms would involve his death on the cross. He could bypass all of that. And one quick bow, the world would be his with no waiting and no suffering. He said no. And then thirdly, the boastful pride of life. That's the desire to achieve things, but for your own glory. This is, like we say, one-third of all sins really comes down to this. This goes back to the motive that Brother Jeb was talking about in Sunday school. It turns our natural desire to be liked, our natural desire to be loved, to be applauded, to be revered, to be respected, into offensive attitudes of pride. Satan took him to the pinnacle of the temple and urged him to cast himself down. This is where the devil quoted scripture that promised angelic protection. Think of the amazement of the people when a man falls the 400 feet to the floor of the valley, but is caught up by glowing beings who set him safely on land. How they would have asked about him and how they would have admired him. He would be an immediate celebrity. He would have won American Idol. He would have won Dancing with the Stars and the Indianapolis 500 mile race. And Jesus said no. No. Because you don't tempt the Lord your God. So with these three things, I want you to consider that Jesus' success over temptation was not just his alone. His success can be yours as well. He did it in his humanity, and he did it successfully. Listen to Romans 8:37. Nay, in all these things, let that sink in for a minute. In all these things, we are more than conquerors. How? By our great willpower. No. Through him that loved us. And so this is where we let him run before us. This is where we ask him and count on him to be the one that takes care of this for us. Colossians 1:27, to whom God would make known what is the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Then consider that a temptation is not a temptation unless you want to do it. The devil comes in telling us that we've already lost our piety because we want to do something wrong. That's what temptation is. Satan's tempting of Jesus, you think about this, his tempting of Jesus urged him to go beyond the limit God set on the things that Jesus would naturally desire. Food, the kingdom, and universal respect. Consider also that since temptations are limited to our ability to overcome them, Satan, when he was tempting Jesus, would have had the fullest range. When he tempts me, there are limits because go a little over that limit and I just fall. I don't have any strength. With Christ, he pulled out all the stops. So the tempting of Jesus occurred. This special temptation occurred. He was tempted before that. He was tempted after that. And each time, it was the greatest lures to sin that Satan could imagine. It was the greatest strategy of temptation that he could come up with. If Christ could defeat such temptations, let us never say that we, who face an infinitely less scale of temptation, cannot defeat our temptations. Don't ever say that. Don't even imagine. He has organized it so that we can. Now, we see then, as we were pointing out, that this emphasis is the commonality of our temptation, of our trial, faced by others, faced by Christ, successfully. So the second thing that this verse tells us, but God is faithful. We see the consistency of God. You and I tend to think that everything's up and down because we're up and down. We have a day of happiness. We have a day of discouragement, you know. We have a day where we feel really good. We have a day when we don't feel very good. But God is faithful. So it means a couple of things. One is God never fails in his promises. Ever. It's impossible. Hebrews 13:5, let your conversation, let your manner of life be without covetousness, gimme, 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 and be content with such things as you have, for he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. If you have that, why do you need the extra stuff? If you have him who has promised he will never leave you, then why would you be tempted to sin to get extra stuff? Numbers 23:19. God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. 2 Timothy 2:13. If we believe not, yet he abideth faithful. If we fail in our belief, yet he abideth faithful. He cannot deny himself. Here's something God cannot do. So God never fails in his promises. And secondly, God never abandons his children. Some habitual sins carry with them the feeling that God cannot love you. If I have done this, not even God can love me. So perhaps in dealing with sin, you feel that God has forgotten you. Maybe you think that God has targeted you for some special punishment, that you're cursed in the face of the earth. If so, that very natural conclusion is that it's no help to turn to him. He's the one doing this to me, see. He doesn't like me because of what I've done, so I can't turn to him. The feeling is that God will never accept you because you are a failure. He will offer no help. He will offer no comfort. Out of spite, in fact, although I, serious point here, I shouldn't joke, but I wrote out of spit. It's just wrong. Out of spite, you may, God has cursed you because of this, out of spite because of that, what he's done to you, you may turn right back to the very sin that traps you. Partially get back at God for putting you in such a predicament. Yes.
So as soon as you mess up, he just grinds you down.
Yeah. Well, the Bible talks about this going back to that sin for whatever reason. The dog returning to his vomit. The pig all nicely groomed for the state fair, returning to its mire. For us looking on, we say, yeah, but why would you do that? You know. But we talk ourselves into it. But God never abandons his children. In fact, in the Old Testament, he uses this as an example. He says a mother won't abandon her children. But even if she does, I won't. There have been cases where it's happened. But we look then at the control of God. It says, who will not suffer, will not allow you to be tempted above that you are able. What we see here is, in fact, then, that God controls how far Satan can go with you. So as it was with Job, so it's with you. God has Satan, can we say it this way? He has him on a leash. You know, go so far and no further. God knows exactly what you are able to bear, you see. He limits the timing of the temptations so too many don't happen together. He limits the length of the temptation, they don't last too long. Spurgeon preached on this text, Comfort for the Tempted, 1 Corinthians 10:13. His message was entitled Comfort for the Tempted, Metropolitan Tabernacle, Newington, Thursday evening, September 27th, 1883. Here's Spurgeon. Note what the text says, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able to bear. Then you could not have been tempted if God had not suffered it to happen to you. God is far mightier than Satan. The devil could not touch Job except by divine permission. Neither can he try and tempt you except as God allows him. He must have a permit from the King of Kings before he can tempt a single saint. Why, Satan is not allowed to keep the key to his own house, for the keys of death and hell hang at the girdle of Jesus, of Christ. And without God's permission, the dog of hell cannot even open his mouth to bark at a child of God. Much less can he come and worry any of the sheep whom the Lord has called by his grace into his fold. So then, beloved, you have a great cause for comfort from the fact that the temptation that tries you is still under the control of the faithful Creator, who will not suffer you to be tempted above what you are able. So another thing we see here is that God cares how far you can go. Notice how sensitive he is to man. Proverbs 18:14. The spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity, but a wounded spirit who can bear? God is completely aware of that. He's not some distant deity that doesn't enter into mankind's problems. Matthew 24:22, Jesus says, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. You see, the temptation, the trial, is limited because he's sensitive to how far we can go. 2 Corinthians 2:7, so that contrariwise, you ought rather to forgive him, Paul counsels, and comfort him, the one who is being disciplined in church, lest perhaps such a one should be swallowed up with overmuch sorrow. God's concerned about that type of thing, overmuch sorrow. Ephesians 6:4, and you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So he encourages, knowing, being a father himself to us, he encourages the fathers not to provoke them to wrath. Let me look then at the compassion of God, but God will with the temptation also make a way to escape. Now this is God's way of escape. The Greek says the escape, make a way, make the escape available. Often our ideas of escaping temptation are not God's best. In fact, sometimes his way seems to us to be the very worst. God's way demanded Daniel's friends to submit to the fiery furnace. You know, we look at this from a human standpoint and say, what's wrong with this picture? You know, submit to the fiery furnace. God's way told Moses to lead the people right up to the Red Sea with Pharaoh's army right behind them. You know, between the devil and the deep blue sea, you've heard that? this was where he told them. It doesn't sound like a great idea, but God knows more than we do. Our ways of escape, what we choose, expediency. We say, well, I just try any way that I can get out of this. Now let's do it God's way. Convenience may say, well, let's try a painless way to get out of this. No, do it God's way. Logic may seek an immediate way. God says, no, it's going to be a process. And then pride may seek an honorable way where I don't look so bad when I'm getting out of this problem. See? But we must go God's way. He established that way so that we could escape the temptation. And finally, then, the conquest of God, that you may be able to bear it. We try to avoid the trial, but God intends us to bear it. That's why he allowed Satan to do it. He wants us to exercise our soul and get through it. He wants us to grow in faith. He wants us to grow in endurance by bearing the trial. Sometimes even the escape demands faith and endurance. I was thinking about parting the Red Sea. Here people are walking next to this unnatural thing of a wall of water, threatens to crash in on them at any moment. They had to have faith. They had to have endurance. It's quite a ways across. They were tested even by God's way of escape. Paul prayed for release, but God instead gave him the grace to endure the thorn of his flesh. Just put up with it. Paul found that God's particular way of escape used Paul's weakness, that everybody now can see how weak he was with this thorn in the flesh, to the advantage for God's glory. Paul, I want you to appear weak, so the people will see how strong I am through you. And after that, he rejoiced in his weaknesses. So, God has revealed this for your strength. As we spend the next few messages dealing with the definition of sin, my goal is for you to hate sin, for you to be stirred up in your thinking, stirred up in your emotions to hate sin. If you are so connected to your sin that you think to hate sin is to hate myself, you've mistaken the whole process. God has revealed this for your strength. Satan desires to hide this truth from you. God says that your trials are common to man. Satan wants you to think you are weird, that you're peculiar, you're strange, that you're isolated, that you are alone. Not true. readjust your thinking. God says he is faithful. Satan wants you to think that God has abandoned you. Not true. God says that every temptation is measured, so you never face more than you can bear. Satan wants you to think that you are overwhelmed, that it's just too much. Not true. God says that he made the way to escape the temptation. God made it. Satan wants you to think that you have no way out. Or he urges you to find an easier way out. Don't do it God's way, an easier way out. The question then is, who will you believe? Romans 15:4. For whatsoever things were written aforetime, our Bible, were written for our learning, the adjusting of our thinking, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. So I wanted to take that time to emphasize this as we go on and look at sin. Let's just take this as God's way of saying this is going to work for our blessing as we learn to hate, despise sin, make sin exceedingly sinful in our thinking. We're going to ask him for the way of escape.